Today is Monday, April 9th, 2018, and we are in the Founders Room at Raven Landing Senior Community. And I am Nona Howard, and I'm here with Doris Miller. And thank you so much for coming today and sharing your story again and being part of the Raven Landing Resident Stories Project. Doris Miller and her husband, John Mark Miller, gave me their story some time ago. However, someone took the machine and it was erased for some reason. And then since then, he died in October. And we are now doing it over again. And Doris is going to do John's part and then do her own, because she helped him with it when she did it. So I'm going to be asking her questions, and these are answers are about her husband, John Mark Miller. Okay, we'll start with the biographical information. Can you tell us when and where John was born?
John was born in Illinois, December 23rd, 1929.
Very good. And where did he grow up?
They moved around a good bit, and so that sometimes they were in Illinois, Ohio, Pennsylvania.
Did he have siblings?
He had an older brother and an older sister, and he was the youngest.
Okay. And so what type of relationship did they have as children?
Well, his oldest brother, well, let's back up a little bit to his parents. His parents were Mennonite when they married, and I think they were in Virginia for a time. His mother drove the school bus. Now, the school bus was a horse and wagon, and she was real proud of that. He says of her, when he looked at her, he thought she was the most beautiful woman he'd ever seen. She really was a beautiful lady, even as she aged. Then eventually they left there and went back to Pennsylvania, where most of their growing up years were, and where they were raising their children. Now, John remembers many things about that community, even though he was, till he came along, they were not as much Mennonite as they had been. But he remembers his mother getting her wedding ring. In those days, with their religion, they did not get wedding rings. I think today they can get a wristwatch, but I don't think they still do rings. I don't know. But they had left the Mennonite church at that time. Now, there's lots of brands of Mennonites, so when I say Mennonite, it was the kind that they were in at the time.
Anything about the children, his relationship?
His older brother, that's what I was trying to get at. They would go around and be, sharecroppers? When you do the work and the people keep the things. So they did that for many years. And his older brother then, before he got into the war, his father was, to supplement the income, he was chopping down trees. And for some reason, he did not hear that this tree was coming down. Either that or it fell a wrong way. At any rate, it fell down on him. And he had a heart attack at the time. He almost died. He barely made it. And then
The father?
The father. Mm-hmm. And so John's older brother, Robert, took over running the farm that they did. He did all. And it was in later years that he became a real rascal. And he was such a torture to John's sister that she said she was never getting married. She was a confirmed bachelor. Well, but she got to Alaska on our second wedding anniversary, and she got married on our third. And she had six children. And the family is enormous to this. I've lost count how many there are in the family, because six kids, Marion, and it, so he had a large family. And yeah. He was thrilled to have his sister here with him.
Yeah.
And
Well, what brought him to Alaska?
The Army brought him. But, you know, Bruce said to him, when he had his sister, John, why do you have that map of Alaska on your bedroom wall? He says, because I'm going to go there someday. When it came time for him, he was in the Army when I met him, and when it came time for him to say, where do you want to go? They give you three choices. So to please me, he put places on the United States, you know, down there for one and two and three, he put Alaska, knowing the Army would probably give him Alaska.
So that's, now, were you married? Had you met him then?
Was interesting. His father then became a minister that traveled and started churches and things. And he would come, any missionary or anybody that came to speak at our church, they stayed with us. So here he came, I don't know how many times, and stayed with us. And I watched him. Every day he would write a letter, walk it across the street, and mail it to his wife.
This was his father.
His father at our house.
Yeah.
And I looked at that day by day, and I thought, wow, that is something. That he'd do that. My father would go out of town and you never knew where he was. You know, he might say he was going to six places. You know, he was worked for Pittsburgh Paint Glass. And so he could be in Scranton or Bellefonte or anywhere. If he stayed overnight, you never knew which town he was in or anything. So I was very impressed, and I thought, man, I'd like a man like that. So we tease that I fell in love with his dad first. And the strange thing is, I never once asked him if he had any sons.
Never. So how did you meet him? Wasn't he at church?
He was in the Army.
Oh, he was in the Army.
And he had just come to my area. He was at Carlisle Army War College when I met him. He was in the Signal Corps. At that time, it was 45 minutes away, I'd say. Today, you can do it in, say, 15. But his father was speaking that night at a thing called Youth for Christ. Mm-hmm. And I was there with my boyfriend. And John was to give his testimony. So his dad spoke and he gave his testimony. And I, just to get my boyfriend jealous, I said, look who we have here, about the uniform. I didn't hardly look at him as a person, just the uniform. Well, my boyfriend got pretty jealous right away. And it turned out that was my last date with him, but it was a big traumatic breakup eventually. Anyway, what is interesting is from the platform, John looked for the girl in the red coat. Afterwards, he looked all over for the girl in the red coat, and that was me. Isn't that interesting? So,
and he found you. And he found you.
Yeah, eventually, yeah. And then the next time I saw him was his dad was having services at several churches, and the at this, not ours, but the other church, Well, the lady that was supposed to play the piano didn't bother to show up all the time, and she didn't bother to notify. So I'm sitting there thinking, oh my, I hope I don't have to play. I hope he doesn't come. You know how you do, you worry. So I thought, well, I'll just turn around and look if she's there. I turned around, and right smack in my line of sight was John. So I smiled. What else are you going to do? And he thinks, and she's friendly. Our stories are so intertwined, I can't break them apart.
Yeah, yeah, that's true.
They really are.
Yeah, that's true. So you met down there, and you were married down there.
Right. In fact,
Had he already been to Alaska? No,
not yet.
Okay.
And he wasn't awfully long there. In fact, we got engaged in a couple of weeks. It's pretty amazing. So he was allowed a 30-day leave to go see his parents, who were then on the West Coast. And, you know, he flew by military plane. You fly and wait and fly and wait. So when he got out there to his folks, he said, I don't want to go to Alaska alone. I want to get married. And so his folks filled out the papers, but they said, well, I hope you don't use them because they'd miss the wedding. That was what she meant. Not that she didn't know me. She only knew me through her husband. So anyway, he gets home finally on a Thursday night, and the first thing out of his mouth is, let's get married. And I said, what took you so long? Okay, he was being shipped out the following Tuesday morning. So he got special permission from the base to be out on Monday night. He could spend Monday night out if he was back by 6 a.m. You know, in those days, you had to wait 3 days to get your test and all. So we had a honeymoon of 6 hours, I guess. And I had to drive myself home. And he shipped out. And it was sort of like you were in the wartime, big time. I'm down at a railroad station waving goodbye and, you know, seeing your lover off. So then he kept looking for a place. He took the train to Washington State, and then the troop ship to Whittier, then the railroad to Fairbanks.
So he came to Alaska then, but you didn't.
I couldn't. It was really fast. And I had to work to get the money. It was $450 one way in 1950. Which now would be a huge amount of money. So it took 2 months for him to find housing, and then I came flying up. It took me I left a Friday afternoon, did not get here till Sunday morning. They were just building the airport out at International Airport, yeah. And so Pan Am landed was then Ladd Air Force Base. It's now Fort Wainwright.
Okay, so you got to Alaska. Did he stay in the Army?
He stayed. He was automatically extended because of Korean War, I think it was. And he was in the Signal Corps, so he would have been taken. Nowadays, Alaska's not considered overseas, and so they take him and move him. But with what he was doing, this was the place to be.
So that brought him to Alaska, and then did he get out of the service?
He did. And first we were going to stay here and build. We bought a lot and started on it. And then he decided to go back to Pennsylvania, and he was going to go to Penn State. He'd already gone to the university up here some, And he worked at the radio station for a while as an engineer. At those days, it's out on the golf course now on Farmers Loop Road. But in those days, you had to have an engineer there. And so he'd worked often at night.
Mm-hmm.
Got off about midnight. And I'm losing my track of thought. Oh, he was, so then we went to Penn State to see, that's a city. And they said, "What? You want to go to college? You got kids. We have no facilities for people with children." This is, back then. So then we moved to Harrisburg, and he took some classes during the day and worked at the first colored televisions in the city of Harrisburg, which is, that's a big city. So we were doing, that was fine. And then all of a sudden, they came upon hard times. So he was the last hired, so the first let go. And in the meantime, we kept getting calls from Al Bramstead at the radio station here in town. And at that time, he'd say, "Come and get us on the air with television." Fairbanks didn't even have black and white television. So we did.
We came back.
To my folks, they were so angry. Mother said, "You'll just go up there and get pregnant." I did. Yeah.
She's afraid. She didn't want you to be pregnant.
No, she wanted to be around when there was babies.
Yeah.
I should be living with her back there.
Yeah.
So it was a very hard year for our marriage, because not only did I get pregnant, I got polio at the same time. Mm. I was only 2 months, and doctors didn't know much about it. So they would tell me, "You're going to either lose this baby or it will be born deformed." So for 7 months, that's what I worried about. Because a doctor would come in and I'd have him maybe 2 days. And he'd say, I can't help you. I have children at home. I can't risk that." And so then I would wait. Another doctor would come. Well, maybe he'd say one day, "We're more in my life than we are John's, but they're so intertwined."
Yeah.
And so I had to learn to walk over again. And
that was all during this year that he was...
The same year. And he continued to go to school while he worked. He'd worked at night. And got the TV station up and going. He was program director.
Okay, so he got the TV station up and going.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. And then he got his master's degree. And he had to have a foreign language to get that, among other things. And so, for something to do together, we took a language together. And what we took was Russian. Now, this was a brand new thing at the time. And so, the night that you were to sign up, this huge classroom was filled with people. And I think seven of us finished the class at the end of the year. That is a hard language. Mm-hmm. So that was our fun. Twice a week we'd go to a 3-hour class.
While you
with
were
Russian.
Pregnant. Were you pregnant at that time, or did you already had the baby?
No, I'd had him then.
And the baby was fine.
He was fine.
Even though the polio.
Yeah, I'd forgotten that. In fact, but I did lay there and just say, "Are you sure he's all right? Are you sure he's all right?" And I lay there and smiled by the hour.
Yeah. Okay. So that's what, and tell us about what where did he go to work after that?
Then he worked at the university. First he was at the Geophysical Institute. I don't know how long he was there. And then Sputnik went up. And as soon as Sputnik went up, everything changed. So the university said, we want a tracking station. So it was called Minitrack. And they would just listen for things that were ahead. So we went outside. He hired all his staff and got it all going. And to get some staff, he went to Washington State, Seattle, to interview people to bring up. And it was the year of the World's Fair. And so while he's working all day, I'm having fun at the World's Fair all the time. It's the only one I ever got to, but yeah, that was fun. And then he got an offer from European Space Research Organization to run a satellite station for them. So he did that. It was out on Estro Road. And because of that, he traveled all over Europe. So I got to go to a lot of places with him, which... You know, we only had a little honeymoon, but we had lots of trips.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. And how many children did you have by this time?
Three. Yeah, three. We had a daughter first, and then Timothy Miller, and then Tom.
Okay, so he's working for ESRO then.
Yeah, and he worked for them. I don't remember how very many, it was a good while, but then NASA got interested. And so the university asked John to come back and open up a satellite station for NASA. Because of where we are, it's interesting. They get a different angle of the Earth that they're interested in. And so that was real interesting. I think he worked for like 30 some years in that. One of the fun things that I remember is when he was purchasing things, was going to get an antenna for a dish for on top of the Geophysical Institute. Now he said, this is a pretty building. And so we decided we would like it blue. So we held up all these little blue paint chips to the sky. Which one do you think really looks like the sky? Because, you know, it'd be up high. And then we went down to Atlanta, Georgia. Scientific Atlanta is the ones that make the satellites. And they said, color? Never. We've never had any with color. Won't happen. So they dickered around and... So he got his blue antenna, just the outside part, the base is blue, and it really looked pretty on the building. And then what was funny is Scientific Atlanta's next calendar came out with that very antenna on the front.
The first time for everything.
And the satellite state dish lasted a long time, but just this last winter, summer, it needed replaced. And there was a big discussion. Should it be white or should it be blue again? And it ended up blue again.
So they still have their blue antenna that he started.
Yeah.
Oh, yeah. Good. So, and then can you tell us how he came to be at Raven Landing? This is a story of both of you, too.
It is. You just can't separate them. We're just too much together.
Yeah.
Yes. Well, I did not realize how serious his condition was. I knew I needed help, and people would come and help me. But all of a sudden... it was just beyond what I could do. And my family, my children came up and they saw this and they said, Raven Landing is really nice. What'd you think of going there? And we had gone through the open house here in the beginning and we said to each other, Who in their right mind would leave the view we have of all the whole Alaska Range and Mount McKinley to go down in the ice fog? Well, we did it.
And we don't have ice fog anymore, do we?
It just was the thing to do, and absolutely love it here.
Yeah.
Absolutely love it.
Yeah. And he was ill when you came in, because he came right from the hospital.
He did, yeah. And our family had moved pretty much just the bed there. So and I was with him all the time, so.
Yes.
Yeah.
So, and then he died in October. And
yeah.
He had a good life. Now we're going to ask you some questions. Is there anything else you would like to say about his life before we go into yours?
I don't know. We're so intertwined.
We're so intertwined.
We really are.
But I want you to tell me about yourself, where you were born and when.
Okay. I was born November 30th, 1931, in my aunt and uncle's house, which was Lemoyne, Pennsylvania. I lived all my life in Pembroke, Pennsylvania, which is a suburb of Harrisburg, in the same house. We even got married in that house. So I'm born in Lemoyne, but that's the only thing, and the rest is in Pembroke.
Is that close by, or?
Well, that would have been across the river. It's in those days, it was a good way.
Mm-hmm.
I can tell you a funny thing about this, though. We, our church would go to the hospitals and also the jail and have hold services for people in this one area. Evidently they weren't big time criminals or anything, because they even opened the cell. It was, you know, one big cell. And they'd have me in there because I was a little girl and unattractive and all this and that. And so one day, we were riding. You get to my grandmother's house, which was across the river. First, you would take a bus, and then you would take a trolley, and then something else. I don't know. It was quite a deal to get over there. So one day, we're riding down in the streetcar or the bus, I don't remember which, and we go by the jail. And I said, "Oh, Mommy, there's our jail." And of course she said, "Shh." And I was never allowed to talk on the public transportation after that. And I'd say, "But everybody else is talking, why can't I?"
Do you have any stories about your parents?
My parents, yeah, I have a really funny story about that. One day they were having a disagreement. I don't know what it was about. Usually it was about money, you know. Anyway, I went over outside, and I was talking to the neighbor, and I was telling her all about my parents. They're having this, I said. And all of a sudden, my mother came out and put a bucket over my head. To this day, I can remember that bucket coming down.
Oh, that's well, did it keep you from talking?
I did stop. I did stop.
Oh, okay. So we know what brought you to Alaska, but did you have a career?
I did.
Okay, tell us about.
I worked for public health. I had lots of little jobs, but I was a stay-at-home mother, stay-at-home while the kids were in school. And then I got what was encephalitis in my head, and I was so sick for so long. It was this terrible eye infection, and it went into my brain. And I was sick for a very, very long time. John said, "You know, you ought to get a job." Well, at first, I couldn't make any decisions. This we're talking like 2 years period in here. And if you took me to a grocery store, I couldn't decide anything. And I didn't remember much. Like once my daughter was working in the same building as the neurologist. And she came by and she said, "Oh, Mom, you're here. How did you get here? Did you drive?" And I said, "Yeah." She said, "You did not." I said, "Oh, I guess I didn't." You know, I just couldn't make decisions. So 2 years, this went on for like 2 years. And finally, you know, I was much better by now. And John said, "You know, if you had a job, you'd feel more like you were okay." And I'm thinking, oh, the last thing I want to do is get a job. Well, I finally did. And it was the change of my life. I started temporary part-time. Then I became permanent part-time at Public Health, typing. And then I went to full-time, and I loved my job so much that I worked past 65. I was 66 years old. It was a very complicated job, but I had just loved it and everything there. And all of a sudden, one day, it became too hard. It was like one day, everything was hunky-dory, and the next day, how do you do this? So I said, "I'm retiring."
Oh, good. So tell us about any fondest memories you have.
One of my very fondest is we lived in Pennsylvania, 100 miles away was Philadelphia. And in Philadelphia was a Wanamaker's building, Wanamaker's department store. That was really snazzy place. The whole building is white marble. And they had a pipe organ in it. Now, if you've ever been around a pipe organ in a marble building, you feel it in every cell of your body. So we would go down like once a year, and I would go up and stand right by the organist and watch her play. Now, this lady was crippled up. It looked like she could hardly walk. But when she got to the organ, it was glorious. And so every year I'd go, well, I wanted to play the pipe organ. I didn't care about piano. I didn't care about anything. No, never got to play an organ until I was 30 years old. And then it grew and grew. And a couple of summers ago, I had a short course on pipe organ at the university up here. Well, I soon discovered organ was fine, but pipe organ's a whole nother thing. And in 2 days, I was done. First of all, I couldn't even get up. It's on a platform. And then that's high. The bench is high, so they had to lift me up. Anyway, one year, maybe 15 years ago, a friend took me down there to Philadelphia to hear the pipe organ, the glorious pipe organ again. Now it's got like fencing around it. You can't get near it. And then when you can watch on a TV screen and see his hands moving and everything, but you can't see it till he's done. And then they turned it off. I mean, they open up the gate and let you come in and see it and all this. And so my friend said, "Do you think she could sit on the bench?" And he says, "No, I don't think so. She's too little." Now, the reason he said that is because it was a short bench, but then it went out like a clock, you know. So it really was quite a distance from here to the bench. But let me tell you, I was there in a millisecond. Millisecond! And that was the thrill of my life, sitting on that bench, not playing it, but just sitting on the bench.
Sitting on the bench while he played it, huh?
Nobody was on it.
Nobody was on it.
But it has five or six manuals. It's the largest working theater organ in the world.
Mm-hmm. So that was marvelous. Okay, now I know how you came to be at Raven Landing, but can you tell us about your experience here?
It has been so much fun. Even though John was sick and he passed and my daughter was sick and she passed, I know they're in heaven and in glory right now together enjoying things. But I have absolutely loved this place. It's such fun. I like all the people. I'm a real people person. And
you like, you can come work on the puzzle at midnight if you work, want to.
I do that too, yeah. And then play pinochle and cards of all kinds. And it's going to be very hard to leave here. It's going to be hard to leave my church because we got here. I arrived on a Sunday morning in 1950, 6 a.m. And this was a little startup church meeting in Oddfellows Hall. And they met in the afternoon. And John said, well, we're going to go. And I said, I'm not going. I have runs in my stockings. None of my suitcases got here till the next day. Well, let's go anyway. So I walk in the door, and I'm only there a few minutes when the lady, she hands me the teaching book, and she said, the class is yours starting next week. I've been there since I was only 18, and I've been there all these years, and now 87. So to leave there, and they're having a farewell potluck the day before I go. Oh, my.
Yeah, and she's going to be with her son.
Yes, that's true. I'm going to move to Everett, Washington, which has another retirement place called Garden Court, and it's only 6 miles from my son. And I have another son in Washington State in Centralia who's very sick with chronic Lyme disease. This is his 10th year with it. But then I have two grandsons and 6 great-grandchildren.
Well, that'll be very good.
And they all get together often.
Yes.
So that'll be good.
That'll be good.
It's the right thing to do.
It's the right thing to do. Well, thank you so much for being here and for being part of this program. And we thank you very much.
Thank you. It was a joy.